Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today, we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll go to Moscow in a moment and talk about the aftermath of the Russian invasion of Georgia on the eve of the withdrawal of the Russian soldiers beginning, or the Russian military beginning tomorrow, Monday. There is a peace agreement. There's some skepticism as to whether or not it will be fully implemented. And we look at the consequences, the broader consequences of this war for the region. And we'll be joined by Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who's a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. Dr. Felgenhauer has published numerous articles on topics dealing with the Russian foreign and defense policies, military doctrine, arms trade, and the Russian military-industrial complex. Since May of 1994 until November of 2005, Felgenhauer had published a regular column on defense in the English-language daily, the Moscow Times. And in July of 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta, which is the only independent newspaper left in Russia. And he continues to provide regular comments on defense-related issues and also for a number of international media organizations. He'll be joined as well by Dr. Anatole Levin, British author, journalist, foreign policy analyst. He happens to be in Pakistan. He covered Russia and the Soviet Union for the Times of London, and he was also with the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London, serving as an expert on the former Soviet Union and on contemporary Russia. And in the second part of the first hour, we'll be joined by Patrick Coburn, is the Iraq correspondent for The Independent of London. He has visited Iraq countless times since 1997, was a recipient of the 2004 Martha Gellhorn Prize for War Reporting, as well as the 2006 James Cameron Memorial Award. His new book is Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq. Seymour Hersh has described Patrick Coburn's work as, Patrick Coburn is quite simply the best Western journalist at work in Iraq today. So we'll be looking into the much-vaunted surge and the analysis of a number of people in Iraq that things aren't quite as rosy as particularly the Republican candidate John McCain is portraying things. I'm talking with Dr. Anatole Levin, British author, journalist, policy analyst, and professor. He's presently the Bernard Schwartz Fellow at the American Strategy Program, Fellow at the New American Foundation. He is an associate scholar of the Transnational Crisis Project and the chair of the International Relations and Terrorism Studies at King's College in London. Of course, he served as a correspondent in Moscow for the Times of London during the Soviet period and the Russian period, and was also with the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, serving as an expert on the former Soviet Union. And Anatole, what's your sense of whether or not this withdrawal will in fact stick?
I think it'll probably stick. The Russians don't want to occupy Georgia proper. They just want to teach the Georgians a tremendous lesson and dismantle as much of their military infrastructure as they can get their hands on. But they don't want to hold territory outside South Ossetia and Abkhazia. They just want to make sure that the Georgians can't launch another attack in the foreseeable future.
And Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer is joining us from Moscow, where he's a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He's now with Novaya Gazeta, which is the only independent newspaper left in the in Russia. And Dr. Felgenhauer, do you believe that this agreement that Medvedev has announced is going to stick? I mean, Anatole Levin mentioned the armaments issue. I mean, didn't the Russians capture, it seems like they captured the most important Georgian base, and are they likely to leave all those arms behind?
Well, it's really quite true that the Russians right now do not have enough force to occupy and keep a country of over 4 million people, and that's no intention. And the of course, the main objective of the Russian invasion of Jordan, of Georgia, was to dismantle the present regime, defeat and destroy entirely the Georgian military, and with it destroy the Georgia as a centralized state, because Moscow would want to see Georgia as a weak confederation with a very weak central government, with all the different parts of Georgia semi-independent, and Georgia without any military. And that's important so that Georgia could never be part of NATO, and because that is seen as the main threat. And this strategic objective has not been achieved whatsoever, because the Georgian military, after 2 days of fighting with the Russian vanguard near Tsinvali, withdrew together with its weapons. The Georgian military is intact. Their losses are minimal. The tanks, say, that were captured at the base in Gori that were shown on footage are T-55 tanks of the 50s, which are totally worthless in combat in nowadays. So the Russians can keep them, but the Georgian military is intact, more or less. They lost most likely 5%, maybe even less, of their manpower, their regular military. And, of course, after the Russians withdraw, most likely the United States is going to rearm them anyway.
But is this to say, though, that a military conflict between Russia and Georgia is, from the Georgian point of view, should be avoided at all costs? I mean, even if the Georgians survived, as you say they did, they don't need to revisit this. I mean, surely there isn't a military solution to this situation, is there?
Well, the invasion of Georgia was pre-planned by the Russian military. And the Russian political leadership, the final decision to go ahead and invade in August was made actually in April. And since then, the Russian government and the Russian military are just preparing the grounds and organizing provocations to have a pretext to invade.
Well, they certainly...
There was nothing much that the Georgians could do to prevent this invasion. Apparently, they tried the preemptive strike to maybe capture the Rokski Tunnel and prevent the Russian onslaught, but they didn't manage, though they overrun the South Ossetian military. But the Russians were already on the move, actually, before the Georgians moved. Russian tanks were moving already before. That's clear from the timetable of arrival of troops at Tsinvali that the Russians began the movement invasion of Georgia before the Georgian attack on Tsinvali.
So, Dr. Anatol Levin, the notion that the Georgian leader was impetuous and preemptive is being disputed here by Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, that in fact this was a Russian plan all along, and I imagine, reading between the lines, Shakashvili just sort of was convenient. If the plans were predestined. Is that your understanding as well?
Absolutely not. Dr. Felgenhauer, as far as I'm aware, has not the slightest scrap of evidence for this suggestion. The matter is entirely clear. Saakashvili has been planning for years to try to get South Ossetia and Abkhazia back by force if necessary. He hasn't made the slightest pretense of not planning this. The Georgians started this war by their attack on South Ossetia, which they regard as part of their territory. Russia has made it equally clear that it would defend South Ossetia if attacked. Russia fought back, defeated the Georgian forces, chased them back into Georgia, and are now in the process of basically teaching the Georgians a lesson, and of course sending another lesson, you know, to any other country they regard as threatening or challenging Russia. But the notion that Russia actually began this war is a truly outrageous one, frankly. And I'm surprised to hear a supposedly reputable commentator make it.
Dr. Felgenhauer, you have to reply here because you're essentially being put on the spot.
Well, I'm not a political analyst. I'm a military analyst, defense analyst. I'm talking about the facts on the ground. That the war would begin in August was clear for me, beginning, well, sort of, well, the first, in the beginning of June, it was totally clear when the Russian railroad troops were moved into Abkhazia. It was clear that the Russian general staff began to the planning of the, actually preparing, not the planning was done beforehand, but the preparing. I know how the Russian military plan. I've been spent time in the 90s in the general staff. I know their modus operandi. It's very much similar to the Russian invasion of Chechnya in 99, when actually we have first-hand evidence that the decision to invade Chechnya was made in March 99, and the time of the invasion was put at August, September. And no matter what the Chechens did, the invasion would still go ahead. That was evidence coming from the Russian Prime Minister, Sergei Stepashin, who really has a first-hand evidence on that. Here we have the similar situation. Of course, it's true that the Georgians were preparing military action to take back by force Abkhazia and Ossetia. That's a fact. But that the Russian invasion, the present invasion of Georgia, was pre-planned is also a fact by the nature of deployment. You know, in the United States, there's only one unit, the 82nd Airborne, that's on a permanent 24-hour readiness. That means after 24 hours, after getting the order, they begin to move out and then get into conflict. Here, the Russian troops were at Skinvali 12 hours, 12 to 14 hours from the beginning of the Georgian attack. It's physically impossible to do that if they were not already on the move before the Georgians moved. That's simply physically impossible. And the other units that followed up, and the ships of the Black Sea Fleet, then going to sea, and I know how it takes, how much time to prepare right now a Russian ship to actually go to sea. No, this was a pre-planned attack. The Russian military were planning this invasion on the time it happened. Maybe they had a time bracket, say, from the 7th to the 15th of August, but they were going in, no matter what the Georgians did. And this was not a reaction. This was not a spontaneous reaction to a Georgian aggression, as it said in the Russian propaganda says.
Dr. Levin, could you further make your point that you obviously do not agree, but we're at an impasse here?
Of course the Russians had a contingency plan to defend Abkhazia and South Ossetia. It would have been grossly negligent in them not to, and to defend it as quickly as possible. But the idea that it takes days to move Russian forces from North Ossetia into South Ossetia along the road through the Caucasus is simply absurd for anyone who has traveled on those roads. The fact remains, which we must not lose sight of, that it was the Georgians who attacked. Now, one can go into background arguments in law and morality about who should actually rule over Abkhazia and South Ossetia, but the fact is that a truce in South Ossetia, which had held very well from approximately 1994 until Saakashvili took power in 2004, was in the end comprehensively violated by the Georgian side, not by the Russian side.
Well, there have been Russian peacekeepers, but it seems to me that the United States was not playing a very active clear role in monitoring this situation. Some analysts suggest that this is a combination of Russian hawks and deluded American neocons allowing something to get out of hand.
Well, I mean, the thing is, as I've written in the Financial Times, that the United States, and indeed any other power, shouldn't make promises or suggest that it's making promises that it has no intention of keeping. The United States pushed very hard to bring Georgia into NATO. The United States armed, equipped, financed the Georgian army, which once again Saakashvili made no secret of the fact that he intended to use for the reconquest of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Although, of course, leading American officials repeatedly told Saakashvili not to start a war, given his own impetuous and reckless character, they should have realized that there was a good chance that he would in fact do so in the hope that they would come to his defense. Well, they haven't come to his defense. And one of the reasons why the Russians are hanging around so much in Georgia, other than, as I say, to destroy as much Georgian military equipment as they can get their hands on, is to make, you know, as forcefully as possible the point that they're sitting in Georgia and there's nothing America can do about it. And then they're going to withdraw in their own good time, basically. Because it's true, they have no desire to occupy Georgia as such.
And Dr. Felgenhauer, clearly the other leaders of the Baltic nations and the Ukraine who came down there and stood in solidarity with Saakashvili, they apparently would perhaps agree with you that Russia is in fact threatening these former states.
Well, sure, of course, they will be next in line. If Russian objectives in Georgia are achieved. Basically, this is the kind of deal that Vladimir Putin offered George Bush after 9/11, and that the United States can hold anything it wishes in the world, but Russia is going to have the former Soviet Union, the CIS, as its sphere of influence, meaning sphere of influence like in 19th century. So we appoint rulers, we dismiss rulers, and we do as much as we please and how we please in Ukraine, Central Asia, and the Transcaucasus. And the Western powers do not intervene. Now, since this deal has not been achieved with the United States and the Moscow ruling bureaucracy believes that's American treachery, that they are intervening into our sphere of influence, we actually sent, before this invasion was fully decided in April, we sent signals to Georgia, we sent signals to the West that we will use force. Our military generals saying we will use force, we'll defend our interests in these border areas if they if they try to move into NATO. And especially about Georgia, the chief of Russian general staff said in April that, of course, 70% of Georgians voted in a referendum to join NATO, but we'll see about it. We can do something to change that. And now they're trying to change that by military force.
And Dr. Anatole Levin, I mean, how do we assign the blame here? Because clearly the United States, with putting in an anti-missile system, which now the Poles have agreed to, but it's been on the table for some time, it was seen as very provocative on the Russian side. Particularly it referred to, of course, as a fairy tale, the notion that it's only there to stop a rogue state like Iran. At the same time, we have evidence that there have been cyber attacks against some of the Baltic states from Russia. Perhaps it's an FSB operation. Certainly, the poisoning of the Ukrainian leader. There seems to be, and of course, there was a massive cyber attack against Georgia in this recent military encounter. How do you pass out how much the Bush administration are being needlessly provocative and how much is Dr. Felgenhauer right in terms of the ultimate motives of Russia?
Well, Russia, like the United States, like China, like any great power, is going to defend what it sees as its vital interests in its neighborhood. Sometimes by pretty ruthless means. The United States, of course, has done that repeatedly in Central America. There is no plan on the part of Russia to reconstitute the Soviet Empire as such. It's more a question of denying to the United States a military role in Russia's immediate neighborhood. As far as Ukraine is concerned, the most important thing to note is that by a margin of 3-1, Ukrainians actually don't want to be in NATO. This is what all opinion polls show. They would like to be in the European Union, but not in NATO, partly because they don't want to be dragged into America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth. So Russia actually, in the case of Ukraine, has a rather good democratic point against NATO expansion. But in the end, I view these things through a realist prism. NATO involves an Article 5 guarantee to defend countries. If the United States is prepared to send an army, or has an army, to defend Georgia and Ukraine, then it could perhaps think about taking them into NATO. But as we all know, in the first place, the United States doesn't have an army to send because it's too busy in Iraq and Afghanistan. And secondly, even if it did, the overwhelming majority of Americans would oppose a policy which would run a real risk of bringing America actually into a war with Russia. Considering that, it seems to me that the policy of the Bush administration, indeed the Democratic Party as well, in this regard, has been extremely reckless and contrary to American and Western national interests.
Well, it's possibly John McCain had a hand in this too, because he's on the phone regularly with Saakashvili, and his chief advisor is, of course, was a paid lobbyist for the government of Georgia. So there's some suspicion that maybe John McCain was playing a more active role than George W. Bush, who had to play catch up here.
Well, quite possibly. But the other thing to remember, you know, is that amidst all the talk of democracy, I have it on good authority that the United States put heavy pressure on international election monitors not to condemn abuses by the Saakashvili administration during the last Georgian elections. And the Bush administration has been prepared to turn a blind eye to a great deal of authoritarian behavior, not just in the case of Georgia, but even more, of course, in the case of oil and gas-rich states around the Caspian. So I have to say, you know, when it comes to the whole question of who is backing democracy in the former Soviet Union, it seems to me it's a case of the kettle calling the pot black. Obviously, the Putin administration in Russia has become moderately authoritarian. I mean, the fact that Dr. Felgenhauer is still there commenting in Moscow shows that we're, you know, far from Soviet days yet. But equally, you know, the United States doesn't have nearly as much to be proud of as it thinks it does.
And Dr. Felgenhauer, do you think that you're certainly welcome to talk about your position as an independent journalist and how much perhaps you are a lonely voice there, but I was also interested in finding out about the extent to which the aftermath of this invasion of Georgia will affect the only independent, if you will, extraction of oil from Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan via the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline that goes through Georgia. There's been a lot of speculation, and of course the Georgian leader himself accused Vladimir Putin's real motive of being to want to own all of the means by which Russian oil and gas is extracted out of the former Soviet Union. So how much is that a subtext, and what has changed?
Well, of course, I'm commenting here on American public radio, but not in Moscow. And of course, the present Russian regime is not a mildly authoritarian. It's a dictatorship. And the media speaks with basically one voice here. Well, of course, in newspaper publications, there are a bit of a discussion, and of course, there is the internet. But basically, this is a dictatorship. And I've been recently spending much time visiting Georgia. It's a much more democratic state and open state than Russia is. Though, again, I'm not a political analyst, but a defense one. And so I would not say how give marks to Georgian democracy, but it's nothing comparable to the situation right now in Russia. Of course, Russia would gladly want to control the pipelines. But what's more important for Russia is to take, not to allow NATO membership of Georgia, not to allow American bases to appear. That's a nightmare scenario for us, that the United States is moving in, surrounding us, and having bases here, there, everywhere. And that's, I believe, right now more important than the flow of oil, because although the flow of oil is going to continue, the leaders of Russia today are not the leaders of the Soviet Union. They are corrupt bureaucrats, and all of them are also businessmen, and all of them are billionaires. And that means that they're much more susceptible to Western influence and Western pressure than ever were the Soviet leaders. And for them, and their business is with the West, and their money is in the West. And they have been bleeding from their personal pockets right now because of the Russian stock market plunging because of this invasion. And that's why, without going to war or sending American troops, basically the West can push the Russians right now out and not allow them to achieve their strategic objective of taking over Georgia and destroying it, which is their strategic. They're not teaching a lesson. They want to destroy the Georgian state as it is right now, a centralized state. And that's why they're so reluctant to move out, because the strategic objective has not been achieved yet. And there's direct evidence that there are serious right now discussions and infights in the Kremlin. By inside, that's what the insiders say, that there's a faction who says that we should march on to Tbilisi and destroy Saakashvili regime, get the Americans fully out, and others who say that this, the price is going to be too high. And it's not clear who's going to take over in this discussion. And the lack of right now strategic decision is reflected in the erratic movement of Russian military columns around Georgia, because apparently the soldiers have not been told what to do next.
An alarming portrait that Dr. Falkenhayer is portraying. Anatole Levin, what's your impressions here? Because clearly we've got... You've got a different perspective on this, but I must say that in the broadest sense, I'm alarmed at the alacrity with which politicians here in the United States are slipping back into a kind of Cold War comfort zone.
Well, so am I. You know, given the fact that these people know absolutely nothing about the origins of the South Ossetia conflict, I was actually there in 1990 when it began. And also in Abkhazia. And given the fact that, as I say, I mean, I'm, oddly enough, in Peshawar at the moment, you know, looking at the security situation on Pakistan's border with Afghanistan. If I may say so, we really have more important things to worry about in the world at the moment than who runs South Ossetia. And I regard it as just a shocking dereliction of duty that the American foreign policy establishment can have got mixed up in this issue at all, given the threats that we're facing in the Muslim world. But as to the plans that Falkenhayer has alleged with regard to Georgia, look, the Georgian army was routed in South Ossetia. If the Russians wanted to move into Tbilisi, they would have done it already. If they wanted to break up Georgia by encouraging more separatism or semi-separatism, they wouldn't have stopped in Poti. They would have marched on to Adjara, which used to be an autonomous republic of Georgia until Saakashvili overthrew it. There is no evidence that they are pushing on to overthrow Georgia. That they would like to bring down Saakashvili's administration by humiliating it as much as they possibly can, yes, that indeed is obvious. But they're not going to occupy Tbilisi. There's never been the slightest sign of that. And sooner or later, they'll get out again. And then the West has to decide what to do next. I can hardly believe that after what has happened, that any person, any serious person in the West, would push now for Georgia to be taken into NATO, which, frankly, I mean, is opening the road to another war. But I have to tell you, I mean, I've been so astonished at some of the behavior of the American political classes over the years that almost nothing surprises me.
Well, just a quick last word from Dr. Falkenhayer there in Moscow. If you're correct, then this withdrawal that's supposed to take place on Monday of Russian forces will be, well, at least we should not expect it necessarily to happen, or if it does happen, it may be, you know, a shell game. Is that what you're saying?
Well, right now it's clear that the Kremlin is actually interpreting differently compared to how it's the agreement of the ceasefire and withdrawal than it is interpreted in the West and in France and in the United States. Right now, apparently, there'll be not the hurry at all. And also, of course, I have firsthand the kind of evidence from people from Memorial who were moving through the Roxky Tunnel together with Russian ballistic missiles that have been right now deployed in South Ossetia, targeting, of course, Tbilisi. These are tactical ballistic missiles, Tochka-Ul, with a range of 110 kilometers. So maybe they'll be trying to cause panic and destroy the regime, or maybe try to destroy military installations using ballistic attacks. Such ballistic missiles were massively used in the Second Chechen War to attack Chechen villages and towns with massive loss of life. Their launches were monitored by the United States, which has a monitoring system on ballistic missile launches. And of course, it's not true that the Georgian army was routed by the Russians. This were 2 days of fighting. Our general staff says that the Georgians fought very well. Then they withdrew under orders. They are not have been routed or destroyed, which is a big problem for our military, and they have been public about it. They don't like it that their launch into Georgia basically went into thin air. They hit, but their opponent just simply dodged the blow.
I thank you so much for joining us both, gentlemen. Yeah, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but obviously you would like to continue, both of you. And
No, I wouldn't. Thank you.
All right. Anatole Levin in Peshawar, Pakistan, I thank you for joining us. And Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer in Moscow, thank you for joining us. Again, this is Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking with Patrick Coburn, who's an Iraq correspondent for The Independent of London. He has visited Iraq countless times since 1977 and was a recipient of the 2004 Martha Gellhorn Prize for War Reporting, as well as the 2006 James Cameron Memorial Award. His new book is Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq. Seymour Hersh has said of Patrick Coburn that Patrick Coburn is quite simply the best Western journalist at work in Iraq today. And we have this strange universe that we're in here in the United States in this presidential year, particularly with John McCain, a huge champion of the surge in the campaign. Rudy Giuliani was referred to as a noun and a verb and 9/11, but it seems that John McCain has taken that mantle. It's a noun and a verb, and the surge. Yesterday, when he did a talk at Saddleback Church following an hour of Obama, he was interviewed with the same questions, and the person he most admired in the world is General David Petraeus. But it seems to me, in a strange kind of Karl Rovian way, that what's happening here is that in this, it's almost Orwellian, that the surge is working, but we've probably lost the war.
Well, I don't think that the effect of the surge has been greatly exaggerated. You know, I find it quite extraordinary that people keep saying to me, you know, has the surge worked? Now, at the moment, last month in Iraq, that 915 Iraqis were murdered, according to the Iraqi Interior Ministry. Now, if you ask an Iraqi and say, are things better? It is better. 3,000 people killed 18 months ago every month. So we're down to 1,000 being killed. We still have 4.7 million refugees from Iraq inside and outside the country. It'd be equivalent in America, if it was the same portion, would be 60 million people. Yet somehow people imagine that Iraq has returned to a sort of normality.
Well, I understand that the genesis of the surge is that it was the Saudis and Saudi intelligence, I imagine, that initiated the payment to the sheikhs and organizing these these so-called local militias, that it took our side a long time to recognize the value of paying the guys that were previously shooting you.
Yeah, that was one element in it, was to pay. The insurgency against the American forces, the Iraqi government, was within the Sunni community, which is 20% of the Iraqis, but 5 million people. And paying the sheikhs, the tribal leaders, was significant. Al-Qaeda had overplayed their hand. Al-Qaeda in Iraq had overplayed their hand by trying to dominate Sunni areas. But I think actually there was another factor which was even more important. But Iraq is a very divided country between Kurd and Shia and Sunni, which was that in 2006, 2007, we really had a very ferocious civil war in the greater Baghdad area between the Sunni and the Shia. That's when we had so many people slaughtered. And the Sunni had basically lost out. Baghdad is mostly a Shia city these days. So for a lot of the Sunni who had been supporting the insurgents, the rebels, people who had been blowing up American soldiers, suddenly thought, hold on a minute, we might get rid of the Americans, but the Shia are taking over. They're kicking us out. So, you know, we've already got too many enemies. And this was certainly their way of thinking. I've talked to major leaders of the Awakening movement, and this was a fear of a Shia government, of a Shia majority, was a prime motive for them stopping the rebellion against the American forces in Iraq.
But the notion that the alleged leader of Iraq, al-Maliki, he recently sort of bolstered the Senator Obama's position by suggesting that he'd welcome the U.S. withdrawal and a prompt withdrawal at that, is total fiction, isn't it? I mean, there's no way in the world that that government would survive for 10 minutes without the United States. And that seems to be... Isn't that the real tragedy here, that the United States it got into this war without any understanding of what was involved, and it's sort of stuck in a situation that's never going to get any better?
Well, you know, it's a complicated situation, this, over the government. The government was elected. It's primarily a Shia government with major Kurdish element in it. Now, would they collapse without the Americans? The answer is they don't really know. Sometimes, you know, they're feeling confident. They feel they can do without them. Sometimes they feel that they'd go down immediately. And I've always found it sort of paradoxical talking to Iraqi officials in the Green Zone, that there's some part of the time they say to me, "Say, Patrick, you know, you're not taking account of our successes. Things are better than you say they are." So I say, "Well, okay. So what would happen if the Americans weren't here?" They say, "Well, we'd go down in 10 minutes." Like you just said. But I'm not sure it's entirely true. I think that one of the problems of the American forces being there is that they remember that the occupation of Iraq has always been very unpopular with the Iraqi Arabs, Kurds a little bit, with 80% of the population. And this is shown in opinion poll after opinion poll since 2004. Opinion polls taken by people like ABC News, the States, and BBC. And this has always shown about 2/3 to 80% of the population don't like the occupation. And the fact that the Iraqi government is supported by the U.S. Army tends to taint it in the eyes of a lot of Iraqis. They tend to see the government as American pawns. It tends to reduce its legitimacy in the eyes of Iraqis. So in some senses, the American forces prop up the government. And in some ways, they weaken the same government.
Well, it seems though that, for example, the person that you've profiled in your book, Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq, Patrick Coburn, I recall, and I guess it's sort of somewhat in the theme of what's sort of just happened with Russia and Georgia, if we're to believe that John McCain and his chief advisor One of the Chalabi's right-hand man, Randy Schoenemann, who's also a lobbyist for government of Georgia, if they perhaps in some ways encourage the impetuous nature of this Georgian leader to bring about a disaster. It seems to be the MO of the neoconservatives, whose main project has been Iraq. In the sense, I recall, for example, Paul Bremer, basically in a way similar to George W. Bush, who said to the insurgents, bring it on, and who talked about smoking out Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. I recall Bremer basically saying, you know, Muqtada al-Sadr wanted dead or alive, we're going to get him, and they didn't get him, and now he's become perhaps the most important political leader in the country. So am I correct in suggesting that all of this breastfeeding neoconservative bluster ends up blowing up in our face?
Yes, I think, you know, that particularly on, you know, one Iraqi politician put it to me, he said, you know, one of the problems about Iraq is that the political agenda is not driven by the reality of Iraq, what's really happening in Iraq. It's driven by what is perceived to be happening in America. It's driven by the political agenda in America. And that's one of the tragedies I've felt really since 2003, is that, you know, every 6 months we have a turning point in Iraq, you know, whether it's the capture of Saddam Hussein, whether it was the original American occupation, the nominal handover of sovereignty to an Iraqi government, you know, that its victories are always being sold. And coming back to the surge, yeah, has had some successes, but quite a lot of what's happened really doesn't have that much to do with the surge. It has more to do with the fear of Sunni of the Shia majority, is being sold as a big success by John McCain and others. And, you know, this is really wholly exaggerated. You know, it's in... when Barack Obama came to Baghdad a few weeks ago, you know, these visiting politicians do not realize the enormous military efforts that go into making sure they have a quiet time. I had one friend who caught 12:15 in the morning the whole of the area, not even on the same bank of the river as the Green Zone where Barack Obama was, but the other side of the river was closed down. He and the other drivers, in the middle of the Iraqi summer, which is incredibly hot, had to spend 6 hours being told not to move. No car will move. There are snipers on every roof. When John McCain went, members of the American embassy were complaining they were told not to wear their flak jackets, their body armor, or their helmets near John McCain. Because if this was shown on U.S. television, it might give the impression that what McCain was saying about Iraq improving and being more normal than was being reported, that television viewers might say, hold on a minute, why are these people all wearing body armor and helmets? So I think that there is a very systematic exaggeration of the degree to which things have improved in Iraq. They have got a bit better, but they've got better than the bloodbath we had 2 years ago. But it's really still the most dangerous place in the world.
And can it get worse? Because there's still the flashpoint of Kirkuk, which they keep trying to finesse, and it doesn't seem to be in any way resolved, and the Kurds seem pretty determined, and the Turkmen are paranoid, and that could bring Turkey in, and the Sunni were put in there by Saddam in a kind of Stalinist way. And they don't want to leave. So I'm just wondering here, most of the time you get the kind of propaganda that you're talking about, which is America's reality, not Iraq's reality. And I wonder sometimes when whether critics of the war and its execution have a vested interest in its failure in the sense that they keep predicting a doom. But frankly, it looks as if it's hanging by a thread, and it could blow up in our face at any moment.
Yeah, but, you know, there are all these, situations. And Petraeus himself says this. He's more pessimistic in a sense that people like McCain, you know, keeps on saying it's fragile, it's reversible, and this is true. I first met Petraeus in 2004 when he was commander of the 101st Airborne, which was in northern Iraq in Mosul. And he introduced me to the head of the police, everybody else, the, you know, things were not going badly and so forth. Then Petraeus left. 8 months later, there was an uprising. The police force changed sides. 30 police stations fell into the hands of insurgents. $40 million worth of weapons were lost. You know, this really is fragile. But at the end of the day, none of these Iraqi factions really like the U.S. They'll try and use the U.S. against their enemies, but they don't really like them. Now, up in the north, and between the Kurds and the Arabs, you've got Kirkuk is something that the Kurds are never going to give up. But the Arabs, increasingly, both Sunni and Shia, aren't going to accept its loss. So recently they've been suggesting, among other things, that the Kurdish city be replaced by Arab troops. The Kurds are never going to accept that. So it's a very fraught situation.
So what is it, just in concluding then, Patrick Herbin, in retrospect, the point I was trying to make was that it seems to me that this thing is never going to be worth the effort in blood and treasure, and we'll be lucky to get out of it with any kind of fig leaf of stability. And at the end of the day, the real winner has been Iran. But do you think that there will be a sufficient political fig leaf to help McCain in this? He's actually doing much better than expected, particularly with the event that took place yesterday at the church. He came across quite surprisingly well. It seems to me that since that's the centerpiece of his campaign, the surge is working and everything is great, and I was right and you were wrong, you think that the facts on the ground will intervene?
Well, they might, but absolutely everything's being done to make sure they don't for the moment. But, you know, bear in mind, back in the last presidential election, pretty well exactly the same thing happened with George W. Bush, that he had the then Iraqi prime minister appear, you know, before Congress and say, oh, there's only violence in four provinces. He claimed that sovereignty had been given back to Iraq. He kind of sold the war as something that wasn't going too badly. You know, then we had, you know, extraordinary bloodbath in 2000, immediately afterwards. And I think this time around, people are really being sold the same bill of goods, differently phrased. And this is assisted by really two factors. One, U.S. Network television reports on the war very seldom now. And a rather curious factor, which is you have people like McCain now, just as you had others in Bush in 2004, say much of Iraq is peaceful. And I and other journalists can't go and prove them wrong because it's so dangerous we'd be killed trying. You know, all these people who tell me, you know, Iraq's so much better. Sometimes in Iraq, they tell me in the Green Zone, I talk to them, they say, oh, it's much better. And I say, well, you'd like to come to my hotel? I live outside the Green Zone and I have a lot of guards. And they say, oh, that might be a bit difficult. So Iraq is, you know, the people like McCain who say they walked the streets of Baghdad, they did it with 150 bodyguards. And I think that, I find it very frustrating as a journalist to hear these people say how much better Iraq is and how much safer. But if you suggest they actually walk the streets for 10 minutes, they pretty well have a heart attack.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, no, thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Patrick Herbin, who's in London. He's an Iraq correspondent for The Independent of London. He's visited Iraq countless times since 1977, and his new book is Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq. I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Lick Duan, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program, of course, is available at ianmasters.org. All archives are there.